Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, press star followed by two. Please press star one to begin. Your first question comes from the line of Scott Davis from Morgan Stanley.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for doing this, guys. Got a lot of questions here, but I guess I just got to stick to a couple key important ones. I mean, one of the key side effects of Basel is it's really going to take up the cost of your bank backup lines. Is there a certain level of CP that we should expect you guys to get down to that becomes more optimal with this higher cost?
Scott, I think I'll let Kathy take a shot at that. She's our treasurer.
Thanks, Mike. Scott, the way we think about bank lines today is about half of them are actually done under our syndicated bank line structure, which goes out into 2013. And so right now we feel that we have very competitive rates, and they're very attractive in terms of a pricing point of view. We haven't heard a lot from the banks yet about repricing the lines, but it's something we'll have to weigh as we go forward. We've talked about our commercial paper in a range of about $40 to $50 billion. So we'll take a look and see if they reprice, how much they will be. But, you know, the banks really kind of look at this as a part of an overall package that they provide for any company. And we certainly have a lot of activities with the banks. And so far we've been able to really keep our $52 billion of backup lines, which are competitive from a pricing point of view, and just about the amount we'd like to have.
Okay, that's helpful, Kathy. My follow-up question is just on your cost structure, and you all have taken a lot of costs out, and I suppose what my real question is your cost structure geared now towards your current E&I or where you plan on being in the next 12, 24 months, meaning is there more cost to come out, or are we pretty much, you get the gist of the question anyway.
Yeah, Scott, let me just take a swing at that. As we said earlier, we've taken out about $4 billion, and cost continues to come out this year. In fact, we're a little ahead of plan this year with it out to about $800. So we're trying to, size the operation appropriately with where we're trying to go with it for 12. So we continue to work on cost, and we'll continue to work on it in the future as well. Jeff, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Well, I think that we're obviously putting some cost structure in around regulatory. We're paying for that through productivity across the businesses. We're still going to be opportunistic around restructuring where we see opportunities to consolidate businesses and we see a real payback. We'll continue to do that. I think from here, most of the big dollar activity will be around as we shrink and dispositions. The cost structure with those dispositions will come out. So I think it's I don't think it ever ends. I think it's an evolving process.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of John Inch from Merrill Lynch.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi, John.
So, Mike and team, as you shrink the book, and I guess I have a couple of questions. First, to clarify, so there's no expected release of reserves you provision based on expected losses. I wanted to clarify that. And secondarily, so your provisions peaked, right, in 2009. Let's say there's $7.5 billion this year. As you shrink the book, what's sort of a normalized level of provisions based on a shrunken book that you would expect? And Mike, what's the duration of the period to get there, meaning let's say it's $4 billion or $3.5 billion, do you get there over 2 years or do you get there more rapidly? How does this work?
Yeah, John, I'll let Jeff Bornstein answer that question.
Yes, I think best we can tell today, we think losses have peaked, and I think provisions as a result of that are going to steadily come down. I think largely through write-offs, that's what they were put up for to begin with. It's very difficult to say that there won't be any provisions on our books that won't ultimately be necessary. We just don't see large amounts of that today. So we think that provision is going to come down as we resolve accounts as opposed to suddenly waking up and realizing we don't need a bunch of reserves. I think on a normalized basis with a book that looks like the book Mike described at the front of his pitch, The Future. And in a credit environment, loss environment that looks like 2005, 6, or 7, I would guesstimate that loss rates and as a result loss provisions would run somewhere between 140 and 160 basis points maybe. I can't tell you exactly when we're going to get back to that environment. It's getting better today, and we hope it continues to get better, even at an accelerated pace. I don't know exactly when we're going to get back to that kind of an environment, though.
But it sounds like it's maybe 2 to 3 years. Is that the way, kind of by the linear basis, or you get proportionally more of that benefit next year? Is that the way this works?
This is not like an amortizing activity. It requires actual losses and credit experience to actually improve through economic improvement. You know, that companies get better, they don't go delinquent. New companies that aren't delinquent today don't become delinquent. So, you know, I can't draw a straight line anywhere for you. The environment's got to get better, and to the extent the environment, the economy gets better to the point that it looks like 05, 6, and 7 credit environment, then we should end up in a place around there.
Well, if unemployment were to surprise in the U.S. to the downside, I know that your trend has somewhat decoupled from unemployment, but would that be a potential catalyst to get your charged provisions lower sooner still?
If I think what you said was that unemployment surprised to the upside, good, meaning the rate,
right,
unemployment rate down.
Correct, yep.
To the extent that translated to improved portfolio performance, that would have the effect of reducing provisions. More importantly, it would have the effect of reducing the amount of new provisions through the income statement we would have to put up, more importantly.
Can I ask as a follow-up, as you shrink the book again, you know, to the 440 or whatever is ultimately going to be the right level, what are you thinking in terms of the targeted payout for dividend to parent when everything kind of normalizes? I know you suggested 2012 is the first year, but I think traditionally you've been kind of around the 45 to 55% payout threshold. But if you're managing GE Capital on a much smaller book, right, to be about 30 to 40% of the total company's earnings, does that not imply down the road a much higher dividend payout to parents of total earnings, like, say, 60% or something like that over time?
Well, I think the initial premise of your question, I think, is right. I mean, right now we're targeting to reinstate the income dividend, if you will, in 2012 at 45%. There's a lot that has to happen between now and then. I think longer term, once you get beyond 2012, if the profitability of the business continues to improve, et cetera, then at some point in the future, we may be in a position from a capital perspective to dividend out retained earnings beyond the current year income dividend. But there's a lot we don't know around that. We still don't yet know what the capital requirement's going to be with our new regulator, exactly where whether we're going to be systemic or not, what might or might not come with that. But within the range that we've articulated today, if we've got a Tier 1 common ratio requirement of 7 to 9%, then at some point beyond 2012, in theory, we ought to be in a position to return some capital to the company.
You mean above the 45% traditional run rate?
Above the 45% traditional run rate.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Steven Winoker from Sanford Bernstein.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to follow up on John's question for a second. The sequence, what do you see as the sequence of events with the regulators such that you really are saying, look, this is, the dividend event is not until a 2012, You know, what is it that is preventing you from believing that that could happen sooner?
Well, I think, Stephen, you know, we built a business plan around reinstating it in 12. You know, in terms of, you know, what our new regulator feels or doesn't in terms of our ability or his desire or her desire for us to do that, we don't know yet. But I think the way we designed the plan is around returning it in 12, not in 11. We think that works from a mathematical standpoint here. I don't think there's anything that would preclude, doing it earlier or later if the circumstances warranted it. But right now the business plan is around 12.
I guess for that business plan, given the amount of cash and that you're sitting on until that point, is it conservatism also around the environment, or again, this is strictly just a regulatory interaction?
I don't know. I think we're playing playing today the way we think is prudent and safe and secure for the business. We've talked about that a lot, and we built the plan around starting reinstating the dividend in 12. I don't have anything more to say than that. Do you, Jeff?
I would just say, listen, I think that's the right way to think about it. We're largely by the end of 2012, we'll be through paying off the TLGP debt. A lot of the cash we're carrying today is, preparing ourselves to be in the right place in 2012. So, from a prudence perspective, I think the plan that we laid out makes a whole lot of sense. And at that point, we'll have something like a year or 18 months under our belt with the Fed and the FDIC. And it's a plan that just makes a whole lot of sense.
Okay. And then on the ROE target that you talked about, 11 to 15%, which is also, I guess, based off of the 2% ROI, to what extent do commercial real estate transactions, equity transactions, and the return of those figure into the ROI target?
Well, it does figure into it. I mean, we are planning for real estate to have lower losses next year and to be better in 12. For us to have a return on equity of in the high end of that range, or an ROI up around 2, then we're going to need some profitability out of the real estate business, which we expect to start happening in 12, 13, that era.
Okay, and might I ask, when you start thinking about that, is most of that range dictated by real estate, or is it something else that's driving the range?
I think in the construct that Mike took you through, we in Future State, we showed real estate at a 1 to 2% ROI. That certainly has some assumption in the outer years that there'll be some equity gains, but significantly remixed to debt and asset management. Because, in the old equity gain model, that would have looked like 3, 4, or 5% ROI. So that's not what we've kind of laid out for you here. It's a much more conserved. Now, for the entire portfolio to get to the 2 ROI basis, we definitely need the real estate business to turn itself around and contribute, but not nearly at the levels that equity played pre-crisis.
Okay, great, thanks. And just one final. I don't recall you saying anything, or maybe an update on WMC or where that or Lake stand these days.
Maybe we'll take that two places. Mark, maybe you can comment on WMC, and then Bill, maybe you can comment on Lake.
Sure, I'll start. It's Mark Begor. I think that we've seen the repurchase requests come in from banks declined dramatically over the last couple of years. There's been a lot of press out in the marketplace from how some other banks are having to deal with repurchase requests. And just a couple points to clarify, first on the robo-signer or foreclosure process, we're not a servicer, so we're not involved in that process at all. Second, there's been a lot of press around the GSEs sending loan backs to the banks. And I think just as a reminder, we didn't sell our mortgages to the GSEs, so we're not involved in that process. And then the last one is there's been some press around insurance companies where the insured mortgage is getting involved in this, and our mortgages, the vast majority, weren't insured. Our biggest exposure was with the early payment defaults or first payment defaults. Those are behind us. That happened right after the loan origination, and we had a couple $1 billion worth of claims that we settled for $1 billion, but that happened 3 or 4 years ago. What's still open for us is the reps and warrants that we did at origination, and as a reminder, Stephen, our reps and warrants are around the origination. They don't rep unemployment if the homeowner lost their job sometime after they opened the mortgage, or what happened with the home prices if they went down, which they obviously did. At the end of the third quarter, we had outstanding reps and warrants of about $250 million pending. That's down from over almost $800 million at the end of the year. We still have claims coming in at $50 to $90 million a quarter. We've got a 25-person team that reviews those on a loan-by-loan basis and refutes them. If you've seen some of our results, you know that we refute every loan, and we've had a success rate of defending that claim in GE's favor at well over 80%, close to 84%. So we feel like we have our arms around the WMC, and we've got a team that's continued to work on winding it down.
Great. Thanks, Mark. As it relates to Shinsei, of course, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about that at the end of the third quarter. As you know, we took a charge at the end of the third quarter when we adjusted our approach to reserves from the low end of the range to our ultimate exposure. That was at our best estimate levels. We took the reserves to $1.7 billion. You know, again, there was a fair amount of activity increase in Japan around the Takafuji bankruptcy. And, you know, based on everything we see today, you know, the losses are performing, you know, more or less in line with what we outlined when we did the reserve charge in the third quarter. You know, we don't, Steve, we don't expect to see any further book up in the fourth quarter.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Bob Cornell from Barclays.
Thanks, everybody. How about a near-term question? I mean, you talk about net income this year at $3 billion. It did $2.3 year-to-date. You know, that suggests $700 million in the fourth quarter, which is below the second or third quarter level. I mean, and yet all the trends are positive in terms of net interest margin and so forth. So help us with a differentiation between what an operating result in the fourth quarter been and what a net number might be, ex divestitures and restructuring. Maybe sort of walk us through what the color is looking like in the fourth quarter.
I think, Bob, I said $3 billion plus.
Yeah. Well, help us anyway.
Well, I think that we're going to be slightly better than $3 billion. I don't know exactly. I mean, we're going to do some restructuring in the quarter. There is going to be some dispositions, although largely most of the disposition activity we think, at least today, is going to happen in discontinued ops as opposed to continuing ops. But our best estimate today is that we'll be slightly better than $3 billion.
Well, as part of the issue, when you pull the BAC into disc op, is that going to restate the earlier 9 months by some amount that flops also into disc op?
It's everything that goes into disc ops will take out of the fourth quarter and the total year. You're correct.
So I would tend to, if you put the, what would be the nine-month result restated for the disc oping of BAC?
Well, for the year, you're going to pull out about $120 million of, $175 million of pre-tax and just under $100 million in net for the year.
Okay, I think we got the idea. Thank you.
Yeah.
Your next question comes from the line of Shannon O'Callaghan from Nomura.
Good afternoon. Hey, question on the you know, the $50 to $60 billion of expected cash at the end of 12, and I guess just what future cash level would be. I mean, you're at 50 to 60 there, and previously you were looking for 25 to 40. So you're well ahead of plan, and then in 13 you're talking about $40 to $45 billion. I mean, that's still a pretty elevated number. What's your current thinking on the future required minimum cash balance that you would retain at GE Capital?
Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
Mike, I'll take that. It's Kathy. The way that we've thought about cash going forward is we've done some extensive work on our liquidity modeling, as well as we've added back the FAS 167 receivables onto our books at the beginning of 2010. And as we look to the future, we think we're going to need somewhere in the $40 to $45 billion range. At the end of 2012, we have a pretty wide range there. We hope to be at the tighter end of it, but, you know, it all depends on maturities because we run our liquidity models on a daily basis. And so depending upon what's scheduled to mature in January, that number may be up or down. But I think the way to think about it is as we go forward, once we get through the big maturity payoffs in 2012, we'll be somewhere in the $40 billion range or so.
And that's just to have a bigger buffer for future events? I mean, you used to be obviously well below that historically.
That's right. One of the things that Basel III is looking at is putting in some liquidity requirements. And so we've done a lot of modeling on our liquidity. And we do some pretty extensive stress tests that's going to have to continue beyond the 2012 maturity bucket. So this reflects basically sort of our broad thinking right now. We'll see as we get to 2012, but our broad thinking about how much cash we may have to carry given the results of our liquidity stress tests.
I think it's fair to say that there's a lot we don't know yet, and this is all unfolding, and we've tried to build a plan here to be appropriate and prudent. So I think that's just how we're thinking about it.
Okay, and then on the 440 plus, I mean, I think you made the comment that the plus partly depended on the earnings of the parent as well. I mean, does that mean if you're still 40% or higher of total company earnings when you get to the 440 that you'll sort of dividend your surplus capital over to the parent until you get down to closer to 30?
I don't think we have anything anywhere near that granular in how we're thinking about 12. We have an E&I target to get to 440, and a couple of us talked about it, but we have a plan, and we're actually ahead of that plan to get there. And at that point, roughly, we think we can grow the business post 440 at a rate that is the same as the rate that the total company is growing at. So that's how we're thinking about it. We don't have anything more specific than that.
Okay, just a last one on real estate. You mentioned the market improving slightly and liquidity improving. I mean, can the pace of the reduction, you're down to $74 billion now, but obviously the future state of G Capital as you envision it has it much smaller than that. I mean, is there going to be an opportunity to accelerate the shrink there now that markets and liquidity are a little better?
Yeah, we have shrunk quite a bit this year. I'll let Ron talk about this in a second, but I think that we're just trying to be again, prudent here in how we think about that. We're bringing the size of the book down as it makes sense, mostly on the equity side. As things improve, we should be able to do that both with a better execution and maybe accelerated a bit. I don't know. Ron, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think our goal is fundamentally to maximize the value of our assets and then bring them to market in an appropriate manner. And we've been doing that. We have sold year-to-date almost $1 billion of equity assets, and as I mentioned today in some detail, collected a lot of debt. So we'll continue on that track.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Deane Dray from Citi.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi, Dean.
If we can follow up on Shannon's question and hear from Ron about what is the bias on shrinking the real estate portfolio with respect to the equity portfolio versus debt. It sounded like there was a bit more emphasis on the debt, but I thought you'd be more selective on winding down some of the equity positions.
Well, the debt progress, as I discussed today, has been driven by an improvement in liquidity in the debt markets, which has created an environment where we've been able to collect a larger population of loans than we might have anticipated coming into the year. It's very good news for the markets overall and actually for the equity markets because we have good debt liquidity that will help improve the liquidity of equity sales in the future. But the equity market is still very much bifurcated. There's a certain amount of liquidity in core assets in key 24/7 markets like New York, London, Washington, D.C., well-occupied, great transparency to the future cash flow. There's not a lot of that kind of property out there. What is out there that's selling is selling quite liquidly and attracting a lot of debt. Beyond that, the market's still very illiquid. And we were not, as you know, a core plus investor over time. That wasn't a population that would deliver the returns that we were seeking. We were more of a value-add investor. And that market's still quite slow. So what we're doing is maximizing the value of our assets through lease-up programs, and as we stabilize our assets, we take them to market for sale. So we don't see the pace necessarily increasing, but if the markets improve in terms of liquidity, we certainly will take advantage of it.
Great. And then, Mike, if we could circle back on the dividend question again, and I think you made it very clear about the plan on the income dividend, but I was just curious, back on slide 10, where you reference about generating surplus capital, would there be any scenario as you wind down Red Assets, a scenario which that would free up capital for a special dividend?
Yeah, there certainly are scenarios that might do that. I think that, again, there's a lot of ways to think about the business as we bring it down. What we've tried to do is build a plan that's sort of right down the middle, and that's what that we talk to. But obviously, if we shrink faster, if executions are better, then things like that would be on the table.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Your next question comes from the line of Christopher Glynn from Oppenheimer.
Thanks. I'm looking at slide 37 on the commercial real estate equity portfolio here. And on the right side, you have a 2010 walk, and then below that, you have a walk to 2013. But you switch the buckets a little. I'm just wondering if you can reconcile the bottom versus the top a little bit more, some of the different pieces.
Well, basically, if you look at the top, we just spiked out sales and value decline. In the bottom, as I indicated in my comments, we've assumed a static valuation environment, so you don't have a positive or negative. In fact, arguably, based on the trends around the world, you could see a modest improvement in values over the next 3 years. That might increase the pace of getting to equilibrium and the unrealized or the embedded unrealized loss. So if you look at the bottom, really the bottom depreciation and losses, the $5 billion in total, is really comparable to your losses, FX and depreciation, orange up on the upper segment. So those are really equivalent.
Okay, and then in the orange, could you just maybe spike out the FX impact you expect this year?
The FX impact is pretty modest. Differentiation there. If we look at the total year, we're expecting depreciation of about $1 billion and losses of around $2.2 billion for the year in equity.
Okay, great. And then a pretty blunt question, but do you expect to be a taxpayer net of your structural credits in 2011?
Yes.
Okay.
We expect our tax rate next year to be positive in the sense that we will be paying taxes as opposed to negative being a net creditor.
And that's with the structural tax credit remaining in the, I think you've said, $1.8 to $2 billion or so annually?
Yeah, I think we're thinking a little smaller than that next year, but on balance between pre-tax earnings and the structural credit, we believe today that we're going to be a taxpayer next year.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And your final question comes from the line of Julian Mitchell from Credit Suisse.
Hi, it's actually it's Alex Virgo on behalf of Julian. I just had a couple of questions. Could you talk maybe in the context of the core growth, how that varies by region, is the first question.
Bill, do you want to do that?
Yeah, sure. I think, if you were to look broadly across the businesses, the Asian markets continue to be pretty robust, with the exception of Japan, which has been soft. So we've seen pretty good growth in Korea, in the ASEAN region, certainly in Australia as well. And that's true for both commercial and consumer. The U.S. businesses have performed very well. As Mark outlined in the consumer space, you've seen the performance improvement that we've got both in terms of losses and also underlying credit sales. The lion's share of the commercial lending and leasing uptick that we talked you through here, approaching 30%, has been experienced in the U.S. as well. Europe has been a soft spot, candidly. Western Europe in particular has been pretty flat year on year. Again, that varies a bit by product line, but, sort of generically, I would say the European markets are the weakest of the places where we compete.
And how do you think about that going forward, I suppose, in terms of where you're planning on the growth?
Well, the plan for 11 was really put together, kind of with the current backdrop. So I would say, by and large, our teams are expecting sort of a similar profile for 11. Typically our folks are optimistic, and so they will have planned for a greater improvement in 11 in the European markets. We may yet see some of that, but certainly the dislocation, the challenges that are kind of rolling through those markets today, will make that tougher.
But Alex, when you think about what we do, how we do it, we have a direct origination team We think the world is getting better. We are working right now to add more salespeople, commercial people to the front end of the business. We're doing that not with regard necessarily to the geography, because we want to grow in all three poles. So we are staffing up. I think the difference isn't going to be where we try. The difference is going to be in what ultimately the market environment is like in these markets. And for most of Asia, pretty good, with the exception maybe of Japan. North America is not bad for us right now, and Europe is a little softer, but we're going to try hard there too.
Okay, thanks. And then finally, just to pick up a comment you made on the business jet cycle, just wondered if you can give some color on how you think about that developing over the next couple of years. And then lastly, just as given that leasing companies generally were pretty vocal against the Airbus next engine option, I was wondering if you could make any comments on
I didn't get the second part of that.
Engine option.
I would say on the biz, number one, the biz jet's not a huge business for us. We have pretty good share in it. Went through a very tough cycle. Not just the financial crisis, but the there was quite a bit of rhetoric around it that came from the administration, other places. The business, fell out of favor. You watch the same newscast as I did on that. It caused some planes to get returned. We had some defaults in that space, and it put pressure on residuals of the aircraft. So we've had a tough couple of years. It's getting better from that regard. So again, not a big business for us, but one that we've been in for a very long time, and it is improving. I think the number of planes that we now have back is something like 40. So it's not a big number compared to what it was a couple of years ago. I may be off 10 one way or the other on that. In terms of Airbus, we think that these things are part of the industry. We're busy today reviewing what the potential impact that might be on residuals. We think that's quite a way out in the future, because these planes actually come out relatively slow. It'll be quite a while. Ryan, I don't know if you know the year, but when it reaches half the fleet, so 17, and typically that's where it becomes a little bit more impactful on resid. So this, we don't think that's a near-term issue. And it's not new. It's happened other times.
Great. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Leah, sorry, do you have any other questions there?
No, sir. At this moment, there are no further questions on the line.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we were able to cover all the questions in just about an hour and a half here today. Just a couple of housekeeping items. The replay will be available later on our website. As a reminder, also, we have an event next week. We'll be hosting our annual Outlook investor meeting with our chairman and CEO, Jeff Immelt, on December 14th. Please visit our investor website for information regarding this event. As always, Joanne and I will be available for follow-up questions today, tomorrow, and the rest of the week. This concludes today's event. Thank you very much.